Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Imagine waking up to breathtaking landscapes, vibrant culture, and a welcoming community. New Zealand is calling. If you are a passionate early childhood, primary, or secondary school teacher, New Zealand says, come teach us. With up to $10,000 New Zealand dollars in relocation support, now is the time to make your move. Find out more about moving to New Zealand to teach at workforce.education.govt.nz. Open to existing qualified primary, secondary, and ECE teachers. Note that this grant is only disbursed after a teacher has arrived in New Zealand and meets the other accompanying criteria.
Hey, Prime members, are you tired of ads interfering with your favorite podcasts? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/adfreepodcasts. That's amazon.com/adfreepodcasts to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ahoy there!
My chute! It won't open!
Don't worry! I'm here to save you!
Thank you!
Up to 89% on the cost of your shipping with PirateShip.com!
What?!
Shall I take that packet?
Wait! Where are you going?
To save you up to 89%! PirateShip.com will save you money on shipping. Savings vary depending on weight, dimension, season, and destination of the package.
Welcome to the Serial Killer Podcast, the podcast dedicated to serial killers, who they were, what they did, and how. Episode 245. I am your humble host, Thomas Rosalind Vyborg Thune. Last episode, we ended on Mary Margaret's final conscious moments alive. Tonight, we continue from the killer's perspective and further delve into his descent into utter madness and depravity. Enjoy. This episode, like all other sagas told by me, would not be possible without my loyal Patreonies. They are Lisbeth, Lisa, Kathy, Corbin, Niao, Val, Madeline, Craig, the Duggletons, Jonathan, Cheryl, Brad, Manuel, Ayulin, and Rachel. You are truly the backbone of the Serial Killer Podcast, and without you, there would be no show. Patreon is updated with more ad-free episodes for my TSK Producers Club, and I also have a bonus episode I am quite happy with for my $10 Plus Club members. Very soon I plan to publish yet another film review, and I do believe you will enjoy it. So don't miss out, and head on over to patreon.com/theserialkillerpodcast now. The sacrifice was executed. His role in delaying the inevitable collapse was fulfilled once again, though the task list remained relentlessly unfinished. The blade sliced her open, her flesh separating with a cold precision, skin and fat sliding apart as if they'd been primed to rupture all along. Blood saturated everything, her dress, the grass, his hands, the knife. A predictable mess, though far worse was still to come. He set a knife aside and forced his fingers into the incision, pushing past the spasming muzzle that gripped his wrist with the tautness of a worn elastic sheet. Inside, he grasped something solid yet rubbery with a slight yield to it. He tugged hard, extracting the organ from the abdominal breach he'd carved, its odd, irregular shape further distorted by his clamping hold. It remained connected at both ends to the obscure tangle of organs still housed within her, serving as an initial point for further exploration. Two crude cuts with the knife detached it completely, and it began leaking at once. Not blood, but a bitter, foul-smelling substance. Herb scooped a small amount onto his fingers and rubbed them together. It lacked blood's purity, instead feeling oily, tacky, as his fingers parted, entirely alien in its wrongness. This wasn't the standard human makeup of blood, bones, muscles, and whatever intangible essence people claim. This was the embodiment of his darkest expectations. Pollution, seeping from their very tissues, so deeply embedded that no amount of cutting could purge it. Poison. It would corrupt the blood he offered in sacrifice. Every ritual he performed would merely serve as a fleeting cover for the pervasive decay beneath. He would need to conduct ceaseless offerings to suppress the earthquakes, and each one would carry this intrinsic contamination. The volume of blood spilled would have to overwhelm the accompanying poison in a futile attempt at purification. Even as his mind rushed ahead, his hands were in motion once more, drawing out one, then another of her organs. They came so easily, like they wanted to be outside of her, like they were rats trying to escape a sinking ship. And every one of them showed, in Mullin's mind, signs of corruption, pollution that had sunk in past the skin to change the very nature of man. He dug and he sifted, and his mind was completely entranced with the task at hand, right up until the final moment when he looked down at himself and realized that he was drenched from head to toe in blood, that there were fragments of human flesh lodged beneath his fingernails and strewn across the grass all around him. He looked down at the poor girl that he'd murdered in cold blood, and she was barely recognizable as a person anymore. She looked like she'd been mauled by some wild animal, torn apart with savagery. He abandoned the body where it lay, ran back to his car, scrubbed the worst of the blood off with a towel, and then hightailed it back home. He needed time to think all this through. He wanted a way to fulfill his task without having to go through with any more murders. He wanted to save the world without having to make any of the hard decisions. Once again, his seemingly opposite desires managed to dovetail into a clear course. He had to kill if he was going to preserve the future, but he no longer wanted the responsibility of seeking out targets. Furthermore, he desperately wanted to make his father proud of him and gain his approval in both their psychic conversations and the physical world that the rest of us call reality. With his father's blessing, in January of 1973, Herb Mullin put in his application to join the United States Marine Corps. This dream soon came to an abrupt halt when the Marine Corps asked for documentation and performed background checks. His run-ins with the authorities, his many visits to the mental hospitals, he was not the kind of material the Corps were looking for. Herb was livid. He had finally devised an escape route, a clean solution that would have kept everyone satisfied. And yet, once again, his past had resurfaced to dismantle it. Predictable. Inconvenient. Unacceptable. Someone had to be held accountable, because it certainly wasn't him. He was, after all, the chosen one, the pinnacle of virtue, a man incapable of error. The blame had to land elsewhere. It had to be externalized. It had to be made into something vile, something grandiose, something that explained why the world was broken and why he, of all people, had to bear the burden of fixing it. And then it came to him. The drugs. Since quitting, everything had been so much clearer. The fog had lifted, the interference removed. They were poison. They had dulled him, restrained him, polluted his system, and kept his true self shackled for years. And of all the toxins forced into his body, none had been more insidious than marijuana. That was the first, the gateway, the one that had led to all the others, and, more significantly, the one that had suppressed his power with the most ruthless efficiency. Whoever had handed him that first joint hadn't just ruined his life, they had sabotaged the world itself. Jim Gianera. A high school friend, a popular kid like Herb, someone who had always hovered at the top of the social hierarchy, and the first to ever offer him a drug. A casual act, a meaningless moment behind the bleachers after class, a damp rolling paper passed from one mouth to another. But Herb saw it now for what it was, at least in his head, an act of sabotage, a carefully executed maneuver within a vast conspiracy to keep him from achieving his full potential. Jim had played his part, and now he had to pay for it. It was time to eliminate his enemy. Herb Mullin was not a hunter. He lacked the necessary experience, and trusting the universe to guide him to a specific target was proving far less effective than letting it nudge him toward random strangers. There were ways to track someone down, discreetly and methodically, but Herb wasn't familiar with them. Instead, he did the simplest thing possible. He drove to the last known address. The house was no longer Jim Gianera's. Kathy Francis answered the door. She was surprised to see him, but cooperative enough. As it turned out, she had purchased a house from the Gianera family and remained a close friend. She knew exactly where Jim lived with his wife, Joan, a cabin further up the same road. Herb thanked her politely, then left. At the cabin, Jim and Joan greeted him with confusion, but they were civil. They invited him in, offered a drink, made small talk. When Herb mentioned that he had a few questions for Jim specifically, Joan excused herself. That was the moment the pretense dropped. Herb demanded an explanation. Why? Why had Jim given him his first taste of marijuana? For Jim, the memory was trivial, forgettable. He had been the supplier for most of their peer group, thanks to his own access to a dealer. He hadn't forced anything on Herb. Herb had wanted it, had asked for it. That was how Jim saw it, and he said so. The answer was insufficient. Herb asked again, this time more forcefully. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Spring is very soon upon us, dear listener, and with it a time to reflect. As a family man, sometimes the weight of responsibility can feel overwhelming. In a society that glorifies hyper-independence, it's easy to forget that we're all better when we have a support system behind us. Therapy can be a source of support for any area of your life. Everyone needs someone to talk to, even psychopaths, even your humble host. BetterHelp is fully online, making therapy affordable and convenient, serving over 5 million people worldwide. Build your support system with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/serialkiller to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, help.com/serialkiller.
Will full coverage make me look cakey? Is my undertone neutral or is it cool? We get it. Finding the right foundation is hard. But with Il Makiage, it's easy to find your perfect match online. Customize for your unique skin tone and coverage needs. Plus, with Try Before You Buy, you can try your full size at home for 14 days. With over 600,000 five-star reviews, this best-selling foundation is going viral for a reason. Take the Power Match quiz now at ilmakiage.com/quiz. ilmakiage.com/quiz.
Help!
Ahoy there!
I'm stuck in this crevasse!
Well, I'm here to save you!
Thank you!
Up to 89% on the cost of your shipping with PirateShip.com!
Come again!
Should I take this package?
Where are you going?
To save you up to 89%! PirateShip.com will save you money on shipping. Savings vary depending on weight, dimension, season, and destination of the package.
Jim wasn't interested in playing along. He wasn't going to let some washed-up addict waltz into his home and shift the blame for his own failings. He told Herb the truth, brutally, plainly. No one had coerced him. No one had led him astray. Herb had taken the drugs because he wanted them. Because he liked them. Herb Mullin pulled out the gun then. The intent was intimidation, a confession, control, a restoration of order. But Jim wasn't interested in that either. The moment he saw the weapon, he ran. Mullin fired. The bullet hit Jim in the back. It did not stop him. Stumbling through a doorway, Jim kept moving as though something beyond sheer will was driving him forward. Herb followed. In the hall, Joan appeared just long enough for Jim to shove her through a door, slamming it shut behind her. He shouted for her to lock it. The decision made no sense to Mullin. He could have run. Instead, he trapped himself deeper inside the house. Herb Mullin fired again. This shot struck Jim in the stomach, the next in the chest. That one did the job. Three bullets lodged in his body, the last tearing through lung and heart, dropping him where he stood. Even as he collapsed, he kept calling for his wife to lock the door. Then, silence. Except for Joan. Her sobs carried from behind the locked bathroom door. There was no moment of clarity, no second thoughts. She was a liability, a potential sacrifice perhaps, but more importantly, a witness. That was unacceptable. Herb kicked down the door. Joan screamed. Three bullets struck her. Face, eye, neck. Even as she lay motionless, bleeding out onto the floor, he wasn't convinced. The gun had failed to deliver certainty. He drew the knife and finished the job. Three more strikes to match the bullets. Mullin could have walked away from the killings with the confidence that he had left behind no tangible evidence, nothing that would immediately lead the police to him. But there was a problem. A loose thread in the fabric of his carefully constructed reality. Kathy Francis. She had seen him, spoken to him, knew exactly where he had been headed and when. It was a simple equation. If he wanted to remain free, Kathy had to go. He was remarkably clean, considering the carnage he had just orchestrated. A quick wipe with a towel from his car was enough to restore an acceptable level of order before he drove back down the road, to the place where it had all started. Kathy opened the door and found herself staring down the black void at the end of Herb Mullin's pistol. She had no time to scream, no time to process what was happening. The bullet went through her brain before she could even hear the shot. She collapsed in the doorway, already gone. Herb stepped over the body and shut the door behind him. If her husband was home, he would have to go as well. She might have told him about her visitor. She might have mentioned Jim. Loose ends could not be tolerated. For a brief moment, silence settled again. Then the distant murmur of voices, high-pitched, not those of a man. Herb moved carefully, each step deliberate as he followed the sound. It led him to a closed door. He pushed it open. Two little boys sat on the floor, lost in their own world. They had been playing, despite an apparent age gap between them. They were children, just as he had once been. Innocents. For a fleeting moment he considered them innocent blood. A different kind of offering, and if the blood of innocence might make a more potent offering to Mother Earth. Before he could finish his speculation, the boys looked up at him. Two shots. The first took the four-year-old in the head. The second hit the nine-year-old as he turned toward the sound. The room was painted in their blood. Across their toys, their books, the floor where they had just been playing. If we believe, and that is a very big if, dear listener, that Herb Mullin was nothing more than a puppet of his illness, operating under the strict command of his own delusions, then this is the moment where that illusion collapses. This was not a divine sacrifice, not a necessary offering to prevent some grand catastrophe. The cold-blooded murder of two little boys was nothing short of ultimate evil. The bodies were discovered later that day. Both the Gianera and Francis households were bloodbaths, of course, and all of the murders had been committed using the same weapons within a few minutes' drive of one another. Clearly one person had been responsible for all these crimes. But there was no reason, as the police saw it, to connect these killings with the other murders committed by Herb Mullin. To make matters worse, the police took one look at the marijuana found in Jim's cabin and concluded that the killings were gang-related, something to do with drug deals gone wrong. The mind boggles at such incompetence. It should, naturally, have been perfectly clear to police that no gang, especially in the relatively peaceful and low-violence era of the 1970s, would turn to extreme violence that included the slaughter of two very young children. It is especially inconceivable that police did not connect the murders of Herb Mullin sooner, when only a few short years prior the Manson family had orchestrated similar deranged murders of, among others, Sharon Tate and her friends. Perceptive listeners might remember that also, in the Manson murders, police were very quick to suspect drugs as the main reason for the killings. With what he considered an ample number of sacrifices completed, Herb decided it was time to pause, regroup, recalibrate, plan the next steps in his self-appointed mission. The crushing sense of impending doom had temporarily loosened its grip, but the delusions remained. If anything, they deepened. It was during this period, between January and February of 1973, that the body of Mary Guilfoyle was finally found. The months spent exposed to the elements had erased much of what once made her identifiable, leaving behind something barely recognizable as human. The abstraction of her remains complicated the investigation. Herb had been thorough, excessively so. His obsession with rooting out quote-unquote pollution had driven him to conduct an extensive makeshift autopsy. Almost all of her internal organs had been removed. Parts of her leg had been surgically deboned. The meticulous but unhinged nature of the mutilation suggested an intent beyond simple disposal. This had been an examination, a study. At first glance, it was difficult to say whether the decayed tissue the police recovered had ever been part of a person at all. But dental records told the truth. The missing girl from October had been found. Her family, at the very least, could stop searching. What remained unexplained was who or what had done this to her. At the time, the city was already gripped by the hunt for a killer. Edmund Kemper had been murdering students, and law enforcement was bracing itself for more murders. But Mary's remains were an anomaly. The level of desecration set this crime apart from anything they had encountered in the Kemper killings. Kemper dismembered bodies out of necessity, disposing of evidence with cold logic. This was different, erratic, ritualistic. Presented with the case, the investigators pursuing Kemper dismissed it outright. It didn't fit. It had to be something else, someone else. One serial killer in the area was already stretching the limits of belief. The idea of two operating at the same time was beyond what authorities were willing to accept. If only these poor, incompetent fools had known. In 1973, there were not two serial killers wreaking havoc on America's West Coast. There were at least six. Herb was on a hike. It was February 10th, roughly a month since he had last proven, if only to himself, that he could kill with impunity. He was feeling particularly attuned to the universe that day, convinced that his actions had helped restore some vague cosmic balance. Nature called to him, its rhythms confirming the righteousness of his work. Henry Cowell, Redwood State Park, north of Santa Cruz, had always been a favorite retreat. He'd been there before, drawn to the towering trees and the illusion of purity they provided. He left his family home before sunrise, intending to sleep beneath the open sky, exposed to the elements, with nothing but the clothes on his back. A choice, not a necessity. He had slept rough before, but now he embraced the deprivation. Civilization was a disease. Concrete, cars, drugs, noise, pollution. Out here, far from the filth of human society, he could imagine a different kind of life. When his work was done, perhaps he'd disappear into a place like this for good, leaving behind the corruption of mankind. What he did not expect to find in the sacred stillness of the woods was a group of teenagers defiling it. Four of them, 3 18-year-olds, 1 15-year-old. They had chosen this place to set up camp illegally, crowding into an oversized tent, leaving behind a thoughtless scattering of trash. Herb had been drawn off his path by the sight of their litter, discarded cans, plastic wrappers, cigarette butts, and the sound of their raucous, grating laughter. A contamination. A reminder that the disease he despised had already spread here. Normally, he would have knocked on a door to announce himself, but there was no door. So instead, he stood outside their tent, cleared his throat, and coughed. A head poked out. Then another. Young, smug faces, grinning at him with open mockery. He informed them that they were polluting the woods, that camping here was illegal, that they would get into trouble. They responded with laughter. Herb's irritation deepened. He told them he was a park ranger, and that they had until morning to clear out before he arrested them. The claim was laughable. He wore no uniform, carried no authority beyond the conviction in his voice, but it was all he had. The kids were unimpressed. They zipped up their tent and continued mocking him, their laughter muffled but no less infuriating. Merlin stalked away, trying to continue his hike, trying to focus on nature, to center himself, to let it go. But their presence festered in his mind. They had spoiled the peace of the forest, made it impossible for him to see anything but its imperfections. Now, everywhere he looked, he saw evidence of pollution. A cigarette butt buried in the mulch, a candy wrapper, faded by rain and time but still present, a stain, a violation. The realization settled in with all the inevitability of prophecy. They were ruining the forest. They were ruining the world. Their laughter echoed in his mind, gnawing, festering, poisoning everything. As long as they remained, peace would elude him. In the dead of night, Merlin made his way back down the trail to the desecrated campsite. Their fire still burned, spewing its filth into the sky. From inside the tent came the inane babble of mindless primates, laughs, jeers, meaningless chatter. The ground around them was strewn with cans and garbage, physical evidence of their worthlessness. Merlin raised his .22-caliber pistol and unfastened the toggle securing the tent. Inside, the boys lounged without a care, immersed in their juvenile amusement. They had no time to react, no chance to comprehend the shadow that had materialized before them, backlit by the flickering flames. The first shot cut through the night, then another, and another, and another. One by one, the bullets tore into them, blood spattered against the canvas, staining the inside of their makeshift shelter. Methodical, precise, controlled. Merlin shifted his aim with clinical efficiency, eliminating each target in turn. Some of them twitched, tried to rise, perhaps to run, but their bodies failed them before they could even find their footing. If they had managed to scream, it wouldn't have mattered. There was no one out here to hear them. No one except Merlin, and he could hear only the steady rhythm of gunfire and the approving murmur of voices affirming his purpose. This was righteous. This was necessary. This was the work he had been born to do. The delusion sustained him, carried him forward as he strode back through the trees, reached his car, and drove home, untouched, unstained, unbothered. He took $20 and a rifle from the wreckage, insignificant trophies added to his arsenal. The bodies would remain where they fell for days. Their discovery would change nothing. It would certainly not prevent what was coming next.
Imagine waking up to breathtaking landscapes, vibrant culture, and a welcoming community. New Zealand is calling. If you are a passionate early childhood, primary, or secondary school teacher, New Zealand says, come teach us. With up to $10,000 New Zealand dollars in relocation support, now is the time to make your move. Find out more about moving to New Zealand to teach at workforce.education.govt.nz. Open to existing qualified primary, secondary, and ECE teachers. Note that this grant is only disbursed after a teacher has arrived in New Zealand and meets the other accompanying criteria.
Help!
Ahoy there!
I'm stuck in this crevasse!
Well, I'm here to save you!
Thank you!
Up to 89% on the cost of your shipping with PirateShip.com!
Come again!
Should I take this package?
Where are you going?
To save you up to 89%! PirateShip.com will save you money on shipping. Savings vary depending on weight, dimension, season, and destination of the package.
Simplify your cybersecurity and data privacy efforts with Compliance Point, your expert-led, tech-enabled compliance partner. Our experienced professionals combine deep industry insights with smart technology to deliver tailored solutions that go beyond the checkbox. From efficient processes to personalized strategies, we make compliance easy for any industry. Protect your business and gain peace of mind today. Visit CompliancePoint.com to learn more.
And with that, we come to the end of part 4 in this series covering a man I choose to call the Earthquake Killer, Herbert Mullin. Next episode will conclude this saga, so as they say in the land of radio, stay tuned.